Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amwha Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amwha Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Well, welcome to another edition of NucleCast. We have again with us a special guest, General Robin Rand of the U.S. Air Force, who spent multiple decades in uniform and retired after leading the Global Strike Command for the U.S. Air Force. But today we're going to talk about something a little bit different. We're going to talk about the people who make this all work. And General, great to see you again. Just to start off, General Mark Welsh, when he was the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, would like to tell the vignette about how when people walk into a room and flip on a light switch, they're happy because the lights come on, but they really don't understand all that is behind that. What's behind the wall, all the wiring and the transformers, and somewhere there's a power station generating that electricity. So looking at the strategic deterrent, you know, two of the legs are in the Air Force's control. What's behind the wall when it comes to people? What sort of people does it take? How many? What do they do for maintaining our strategic deterrent?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Jim. First of all, welcome. Thanks for having me back on. Yeah, it is. That's so well said. General Welsh said it perfectly. I mean, it is our people. Air Force Global Strike, roughly, give or take, has close to 34,000 men and women assigned to the command. They're located at a lot of locations. I think 10 different places, CONUS, and then we're typically have airmen deployed somewhere around the world, whether it's in Guam, the Middle East, Australia. We're supporting a lot of the combatant commands. So really busy, very difficult. Obviously, you mentioned two legs of the triad, the land leg, the intercontinental ballistic missile leg, and the air leg, our bombers. But we also do a lot of the command and control for the nuclear enterprise. It takes the missile and bomber maintainers. It takes our air crews. It takes our missile operators. It takes security forces. It really, when you start talking about who's the least and who's the most important on any given day, sometimes it's the person sitting behind just doing the paperwork. The chefs are incredibly important in Air Force Global Strike because they make sure there's food in the belly of those defenders that are out there protecting and serving the air crews and the operators. So it was a marvelous experience, and the 34,000 plus airmen were exquisite. So.
And there's really a difference, if you think about it kind of conceptually, between the land-based strategic deterrent and the bomber fleet. Mm-hmm. You know, one being very static, they sit in place. The other being very dynamic, they fly all over the world and are ready to respond at a moment's notice. Could you talk a little bit about the difference in challenges in maintaining and operating, you know, such diverse?
Yeah, well, first of all, it was a conscious decision for the missile leg. To where we've located those, and we talk about areas of responsibility in the military, your AOR. Well, for the missile folks, their AOR, they're deployed in place. They serve and deploy here in the United States and in places like Cheyenne, Wyoming, Great Falls, Montana, and Minot, North Dakota. And as you can imagine, those can be very, very challenging locations to get out to the missile sites, particularly in the winter, with very cold, very austere, very challenging weather conditions that we deal with. We're also confronted, you know, when we talk about AORs, is it a contested AOR or not? And I always would say in Air Force Global Strike that the missile AOR was contested. It was contested by weather. It was contested by encroachment, land, you know, folks that were, because you're right out here in the United States. And then we always had to be aware of that you know, there are bad people who want to do ill will towards the United States. And so we always had to be vigilant that we were ready to protect these very critical sites where our missiles are located and housed. So very challenging for them. In the air piece, we operate out of Minot, Whiteman Air Force Base, Dyess Air Force Base in Abilene, Texas, Ellsworth and Rapid City, South Dakota, and then Barksdale, which is in Bossier City in Shreveport, Louisiana. But at any given time, there are bombers somewhere else in the world on TDYs deployed, okay, and is a projection of force. So again, some of those locations are very challenging, whether it's the heat, whether it's the austere, very cold, cold winters. And then when we deploy, you're dealing with whatever conditions we go to. The Middle East, hot, sandy, dusty, difficult. If we go to Guam, you're very high humidity, the tropics. So always very challenging, but a different mindset. The bombers can operate out of these locations, but they also will deploy for extended periods of time where the missile folks, they deploy in place. So that's one of the distinctions right off the bat.
Right. So you mentioned the maintenance and keeping these assets, you know, operationally ready. We're looking at the Minuteman are, you know, decades and decades old. Can you talk a little bit about the maintenance challenges to keep them ready to
go? That's a great question. Thank you. Again, our young men and women are exquisite. You know, they're working on a lot of these maintainers, as we call them, are working on weapon systems that are two or three times older than they are. The Minuteman III for our ICBM, our land component of the Triad, the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, was first employed in 1970. Do the math, that's 54 years old. So you have 20-year-old, 22-year-olds working on a system that's two to three times their age. The youngest B-52 in the inventory first flew in 1961. Again, I'm not good math in public, but I think that's 63 years old. Imagine taking a car out on the freeway and driving the speed limit of 65 or 75 miles an hour with a 63-year-old car. It just doesn't happen. But this is the kind of professionalism and dedication these young men and women, and they maintain these airplanes and these missile systems exquisitely. But it's challenging. You know, when we're hurting for parts, it's hard now. A lot of the parts aren't being made anymore, so we have to manufacture our own parts. But it's difficult. Now, I will say the B-52, I don't want anyone to be misled here. While it's a 63-year-old airplane, a lot of time and effort has been put into modernizing the B-52 to make it a 21st century platform. New radars, new avionics, new engines are going in, a whole lot of time and effort. So while the guts and the bones of the airplane are 63 years old, the capabilities are right up to speed. And we're going to be flying the B-52 as an example for another 30, 40 years, in my estimation. You know, that I'm convinced of that. The B-2, our newest bomber, is aging out, and we have a replacement to replace the B-2 and the B-1 bomber with what's called the B-21. And it's just around the corner, and that should be coming out. And again, that'll be the latest and greatest technology known to the universe. So the Minuteman III is being replaced by what we now are calling the Sentinel weapon system. And so a lot of encouraging things happening in the nuclear enterprise. A lot of modernization has been going on with the missiles, with the airplanes, in the Air Force. We're replacing what's called the air launch cruise missile with the long-range standoff weapon, LRSO, which is a much greater capability that we can put on the B-52s, for example, to be able to have a very good standoff capability. So good things are happening in the community and the enterprise, albeit late, but better late than never.
I would imagine that if you're a young maintainer up in Minot, North Dakota, and it's 30 below zero in the middle of winter, it's going to take a lot of special leadership skills to keep that person motivated. Could you talk a little bit about that? And
sure.
You know, how are
I'll be happy to, you know, but it gets to the heart of the matter of why do people join? And, you know, our men and women come in for a variety of reasons, and none is necessarily better than the other. But I think the more important one is why do they stay once they come in? And I think it gets rooted in our core values of you know, integrity, service before self, and excellence in all we do. And it's a drumbeat. It's a consistent drumbeat. And these men and women come in, and ordinary Americans who do extraordinary things is how I like to categorize them. And they're self-motivated. You know, they're not doing it for the travel. They're not doing it for the pay. They're not doing it for a lot of the things to see the world. They do it because they end up believing what they're doing. I remember in February of 2018, I went to Minot, North Dakota for a week-long visit. We were doing what was called a senior leader conference there, and I brought all the commanders and the senior NCO chief, master sergeants, command chiefs are called, the senior staff from the headquarters, and our civic leaders from around the command, and we went to Minot for a week. And I intentionally picked February of 2018 because I wanted people to appreciate, if you've never been stationed at Minot, what it's like to work in those conditions in the winter. Got exactly what we wanted. It never rose above probably 10 below zero that entire week. But I tell you the story because I went out early in the week to fly with a B-52 crew. They had just recently redeployed from 6 months in the Middle East flying combat. And I went and did a training sortie with them. And when we showed up at the airplane, I remember the two young crew chiefs, probably 22, 23 years old. They had these big corduroy overalls on, and we show up all bundled up. You know, it's 30 below zero out. And it dawned on me that when I got to the airplane, we quickly got into the cockpit, into a nice 60, 65 degree cockpit. Those young men stood out there for another hour. They probably were out there an hour before we showed up and stayed an hour, as it takes a while to launch and get the B-52 rolling. And it dawned on me again, you know, what we ask of these guys and gals to do for us. That's just one example of how proud I am of them. And, you know, all I could tell them was thank you for your service, you know. Not nearly enough, but certainly came from the heart.
I can tell you from personal experience, I got to go to dinner with a KC-46 crew recently, and they were all, you know, half my age, if not younger. But what professionals! They were serious about their jobs. They love their country. They're going to do this. And one kid, it really struck me. He was from a very impoverished background in an inner city in California. And he said, this is my ticket out. And he says, I'm staying as long as they'll keep me because, you know, I love the people. I love the mission. And better yet, this is training me life skills so that when I do go home, I'll be able to start my own business, whatever. I'm very impressed by that. So great
I am too. And again, your reasons for joining are your reasons. But I was often asked, you know, why I joined. And I said, well, later in my career, I said it was so long ago, I can't remember. But the more important question is not why I joined, but why I stay. And I really think it becomes crystallized in the mission. It's a noble mission we do. The airmen that we serve with and the families that we support are three good reasons. We concentrate on Minot with its cold Malmstrom FE, but it's not easy operating on the flight lines and in the places where it's 105 degrees in the summer with high humidity and that flight line heats up. So wherever we ask our airmen to serve, they're putting in some physical blood, sweat, and tears to make the mission happen. And I'm really proud of where all our airmen across the Air Force serve, but particularly those in Air Force Global Strike.
One other thing that you as a longtime pilot understand is the evolution of the technologies that go into our bomber leg of the deterrent. You know, if you go back to World War II, they're all propeller driven. Then we got into the jet age. But, you know, even with these modernization efforts with the B-52 and whatever, but how does that affect, you know, the training, the motivation,
right.
the whole
fair
scheme
question.
Of things?
There's nothing easy about operating these weapon systems, and it requires, for every hour of flying, probably requires three times that in training and studying and just being prepared. Nothing easy about that. Nothing easy about our maintenance. Nothing easy about what our defenders do. Everything we ask people to do, we spend a lot of time and effort. And I think that's what separates us, our military, the United States military in general, from particularly a lot of our foes' military, is we train very, very hard. We spend a lot of time training and preparing, and that's critical. So call it chair flying or whatever you want to call it, but there's a lot of preparation that goes into mission execution. You don't just show up and execute. The missileers test weekly. You know, they have oral and written tests that they take continuously throughout. And same with our maintainers and everyone. I mean, you're continually a student as you serve in the military. So that's the biggest thing. Today, the systems, I would argue, are very complicated. The avionics, and it requires a lot of time and effort. There's nothing easy about this. So, again, we're flying. Sometimes our systems are old, but they have the capabilities of the 21st century, and it requires a lot of time and effort. I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Yeah, you sure did. And it's time now to take a real quick break. So we'll be right back to continue part two of our conversation with General Rand. Thank you.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back with General Robin Rand to talk about the strategic deterrent and the two legs of the strategic triad. But why do we have three legs, General? How did that come about?
Thank you. I like that question. It's a fair one. And in very few nuclear capable countries have that. We do. And it is to provide the ultimate flexibility to the President of the United States. And each leg has a unique feature to it. So we'll talk about the sea leg that I'm not part of per se, but the sea launch ballistic missiles of submarines, and they are very, very, very hard to detect, as you can imagine. And so that provides really great survivability. For the land leg, the intercontinental ballistic missile, we're on 24/7 alert. So that's a very responsive option that the president would have. If he needed to respond immediately, he has the ICBMs that are on alert. And then the air leg, the bomber leg, is very, very flexible because it's something that you can generate. You could actually launch the airplane, take off, and then still have the ability to recall that. So that's an option that is very, very attractive for, again, our senior decision makers. The use of nuclear weapons is extremely difficult, and we would hope would never ever have to be, you know, executed, but it does provide our president the maximum flexibility, I think, having those three unique components. And that's one of the reasons why that's been a feature of our nuclear enterprise since the Eisenhower administration.
Yeah, it's really, really amazing to look at the history where we went from basically the ashes of World War II up into the late 1950s with just one leg of the current triad.
Right.
And I know that the Atlas development was extremely expensive at the time. They made
sure
it priority number one. They really did.
The one thing I'll mention is this is a very bipartisan decision. Every administration since Eisenhower in the late 50s has elected to keep the triad. And there's a couple other commonalities that every administration, regardless if they're Democrat or Republican, there's some things that have been consistent throughout. So
looking back at your experience as a pilot, you started off as a first assignment instructor pilot. And then later, a long time later in your career, you actually commanded the Air Education and Training Command.
Right.
So you got to see several decades worth of kind of changes and how these new technologies are coming to the air fleet. How do we train our pilots? So are there any basic lessons learned from changes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, thanks for asking. So I'll just use myself as an example. I went through pilot training. I started shortly after I graduated from the academy in 1979, finished in 1980, a year later. And back then we had what was called just undergraduate pilot training, UPT. And it was generalized, and we all did the same thing. There were two airplanes. We spent our first 6 months and then the T-37, and then everyone went through the T-38 for the last 6 months. And then you got your assignment, whatever it was, whether you're going to be a fighters, mobility, tankers, bombers. We all flew the same. For various reasons in the probably the 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And part of it was to spread out the health and wellness of the T-38 and ensure it would still be around for a while. We went to what we now call specialized undergraduate pilot training. And now everyone starts off in the T-6, which replaced the T-37. And then after your T-6, you go on a different track. And some go to what's called the mobility track, and some go to the fighter bomber track. So some fly the T-1, and then some will go fly the T-38. Now that's changing as well, because we're hoping to bring on shortly a new replacement for the T-38 called the T-7. And UPT is evolving. Safe to say it is evolving, but it's still primarily about 11 months long. And regardless of what track you go through, when you get your pilot wings, you're good. You're good. You're ready. And then you'll go for another up to 6 months to a year of follow-on training before you ever show up. So when you show up, your son showed up as a KC-46 pilot. He'd gone through about 2 years on and off, mostly on, of some pretty intense training. And then when he showed up at his new unit, he had to get, indoctrinated into that. So it's a long process by the time you finally become combat mission ready in the system you're flying.
Which is probably a very good
question.
You sure did. It's probably a very good thing that it takes a lot of training to get people out, because these are very complex systems that they're flying. So
it is.
So I was just going to ask you, we hear a lot about each generation that follows us as not being as good as we are. We hear about the greatest generation from World War II. And quite frankly, the current generation of youngsters, the early 20-year-olds, they get a pretty bad rap. It's certainly not been my experience, but what are your thoughts about, the quality of people that we're bringing into the force these days?
No,
how do you assess that?
Well, first of all, I do want to do a shout out to those that came before us. My father was a World War II veteran, Vietnam and the World War II, Korean Vietnam. And I have no problem calling the World War II veterans our greatest generation. And there are very few left, as we know. I mean, D-Day, what did we just celebrate? Our 80th anniversary of D-Day. And the young men who served then were probably in their late teens, early 20s. So do the math. If you're alive and you're a World War II veteran, you're over 100, or you're pushing 100. And they saved the world. Let there be no doubt. They saved the world at that time. And I'm forever grateful for them. Today's young men and women, though, I think are equally spectacular. And I'll tell you why. today we make up those who serve in the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Space Force, Coast Guardsmen. They make up less than 2% of the population. We have a country of roughly 350 million people, and less than 2% serve in the military. So ponder that for a minute. Okay. And so those 2% are pretty sharp young men and women. And again, for whatever reason they come in, they do a bang up job. And if you don't believe that, just look around. And they serve, they sacrifice, and they defend us and they protect us. And so I haven't found them to be anything but exquisite. Again, I come back to ordinary people who are willing to do extraordinary things. And they prove that time and time and time again. And it's one of those gifts you can't really put a price tag on, that we have them who do this. So don't believe it. I think this generation of young men and women in the military are the best our country has to offer. And they impressed me every day. I'm still able to be around them. In fact, today I'm part of a seminar on frontline leadership, working with young airmen from Air Force Global Strike who are first-time supervisors. The average age, probably their mid-20s. And so they're as good, as sharp, as intuitive, and as capable as any generation that's come before them. So, gang, don't buy that, okay? You know, I can't speak for all of society, but I can tell you the men and women that are wearing our nation's cloth are spectacular.
Well, that's very, very great to hear. You know, one of the challenges that comes when you are deploying on a B-52 or even on the transport side, you know, a C-17, a lot of these people are away from home, you know, 200 to 300 days a year. That's going to be a special challenge on the family front.
Yeah, it is. And even as I said, when we talk about our missileers and those who work and maintain and operate, they're deployed in place. And that's a lot of time out in the missile fields. But by nature, we're expeditionary. We want to fight our nation's battles, not on our home, you know, other places. And so it's not unusual if you do a 20-year career that you will have spent a chunk of that, when you add all the deployments up and your time away, it starts to add up. It's quite a sacrifice, not only for the men and women who serve, but for our families. And I used to say, airmen serve, our family sacrifice. Okay, because, and they do, whether it's frequent moves, separation away from people, from your loved ones. There's nothing easy about being a family member supporting someone who's serving in the military. And so my love and admiration for those people are equal to the men and women who serve. Nothing easy about this business. Nothing easy at all, but rewarding and noble and critical. So be grateful, gang, people who are listening to this, be grateful that we have those that are willing to stand in the gap for you and I while we sleep comfortably at night. Be grateful that you got American soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, Guardians stand and watch.
And part of the trade-off is, aside from the great sacrifice they make, your typical enlisted person, officer, whatever, walks away with some skills that can be used in the civilian workforce when they're out of uniform.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, a lot of skills, not only, you know, hard-earned technical expertise, but, you know, if you serve in the military, you learn to be a follower and you learn to be a leader. And these are exportable to whatever, school teaching, coaching, selling cars, business practices. It's all very exportable. And I will tell you that those who are in the military are good citizens, good model citizens, good examples for our children and for the rest of society. Again, am I biased? I certainly am. I admit that, but I'm unapologetic about it too.
So any final thoughts about, you know, the characteristics of Team Air Force when it comes to preserving not just our strategic deterrent, you know, operating it, but also everything else the Air Force does? I understand that every 2 minutes there's a Air Force transport moving somewhere around the world, just, you know, people and materials. It's just incredible. Like I said, behind the wall of that light switch, there's so much going on that you never really think about. Any final words on that?
Well, I think you just said it. I mean, it takes a village, you know, and with our Guard, active duty, reserve, and civilians, we're about a 700,000 person. Don't quote me on that, but give or take, men and women who make up the United States Air Force. And on any given day, any one of those people might be doing the most important thing that's being done for the Air Force that day. And they're servants, and they're humble, and they're defending us. And I just can't say enough for it. It's okay that America is blissfully ignorant about a lot of the things that our men and women in the military do. That's okay. We don't need a lot of fanfare, but I just hope that we don't take for granted, because it's a wily world out there. And there are a lot of people who have ill will towards the American way of life. And this concept and notion of freedom isn't free. Someone's paying for it every day. And I think we should be mindful of that and be grateful for those men and women who serve. A lot of people do noble things. You know, I love our first responders, our firefighters, our defenders, our paramedics, you know, school teachers. There's so many, but you know, we have this thing called freedom that has to be paid for with every single generation. And today's generation is pretty high speed. And I'm grateful that I was able to serve with them for the better, you know, the better part of my life.
Well, General, that's a pretty uplifting message. And I join you in saluting the incredible men and women out there on the front lines, because they do a terrific job. Absolutely. And his team is top notch. So great to see that. But again, thank you so much for your service and for your time here on NucleCast. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and hopefully we'll do it again soon. So
thanks,
with that,
Jim.
We'll sign off.
Kimberly, thank you. It was wonderful being with you over the last couple of weeks. I really appreciate the time.
We'll do. Thank you, General. Take care.
Yes, sir. See you later.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it, and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.